True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
So 1998 was a shocking and disturbing year for the residents of Port Angeles, Washington. First, a three-day-old infant died at the hands of beloved pediatrician Dr. Eugene Turner. Then, the wife of ER physician Bruce Rowan was found hacked to death inside of her car. But were these two deaths connected? Well, let's find out. Join us at the quiet end for a very bad year in Port Angeles. Dr. Eugene Turner was considered saint-like by Port Angeles families. He had delivered at least one-third of the babies born at the Olympic Peninsula Hospital over the past 30 years. He donated to Habitat for Humanity, cut wood for disadvantaged families, and he could even be seen picking up trash on the side of Highway 101. Dr. Bruce Rowan was a respected emergency medicine physician with a nice home and a young family. So what happened in 1998 to turn these two formerly irreproachable men into murder suspects? It's an interesting conversation.
It's going to be. So we have a Seattle beer for today. This is from Fremont Brewing Company. It's bourbon barrel aged Dark Star, and it's the coffee edition. This is an oatmeal stout, 13.6% alcohol by volume. So be careful, kiddies. It's black, has a small tan head, nice aroma, dark fruit, roasted malt, and alcohol. And the taste gets even better. We got some espresso, milk chocolate, raisin, vanilla, and bourbon. This beer is a pretty smooth drinker, and I think it's way too easy to drink for a beer of that alcohol.
So your warning is really for real?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
We don't do this lightly.
No. Take it very seriously.
So yeah, this... it comes in like a bomber bottle, 19, 20 ounces. Share among three or four people. That'll work.
That'd be nice to sit down, have a nice conversation with friends, and sip it. Sounds lovely.
Yes, just remember to sip it.
Absolutely. Okay, let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, down here at the quiet end.
It is pretty quiet today.
Yeah, well, we're doing things a little earlier than usual, so all of our barflies have not come in yet.
That's true. They're expecting us in a couple hours, aren't they?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, well.
We'll still be here drinking beer, so it's okay.
It is.
So why don't you get us started on this story?
So on the afternoon of Monday, January 12th, 1998, Dr. Eugene Turner was in his Port Angeles, Washington pediatric office, watching a snowstorm through the window. The Peninsula Children's Clinic was right across the street from Olympic Memorial Hospital, which made it convenient for him to walk over to the hospital whenever he was needed during the day.
Yeah, so that was his clinic, and he was in his early 60s and had been there a very long time.
He had been. Now, but that day, due to the snowstorm, he had closed up the office, and he had planned to go ice skating with a disadvantaged 14-year-old boy. Now, this was the type of thing that Dr. Turner often did as part of his dedication to his community. But after-school activities had already been canceled due to the storm. Dr. Turner didn't want to let the boy down, but after speaking with his wife, he decided it'd be better to reschedule the ice skating for another day. Dr. Turner was loved by the families of Port Angeles. He had delivered most of their children, and the community trusted him.
And we'll see a lot of evidence of that later on in the story. Dr. Turner had served in the Peace Corps before moving to Port Angeles, where he was known for his philanthropy and just general kindnesses. So just after 5 p.m. on that Monday of January 12th, Dr. Turner left his office for home. But around that same time, young couple Michelle and Martin McInerney were spending a quiet afternoon with their newborn son, Connor. Michelle had just given birth to Connor at the Olympic Memorial Hospital on the Friday before this storm. She and Connor had been discharged on Sunday to their tiny home on the west side of Port Angeles. That Monday afternoon, in the middle of the snowstorm, Marty's friend Byron Sifford came over for a visit, which wasn't unusual. Marty and Byron were really close buddies. So Byron had brought over a board game that he had received as a birthday gift to play with Martin and Michelle. And that might sound a little strange, but these were very young people, 20, 21 years old.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound too strange to me. Stuff they like to do.
I know, but it's the middle of a snowstorm, and it's a board game he got for his birthday, so it sounds a little childish.
Well, it might be a little bit, but
yeah,
like you said, these are young kids.
They're very young, so it's definitely understandable. So at first, when Byron got there, baby Connor was in his swing, but then he began crying, and Michelle picked him up to walk with him and comfort him, settle him down. After a while, though, Connor seemed to be hungry. He was kind of rooting around. So Michelle reclined on the sofa to breastfeed him as they continued to play the game. But Connor continued to be fussy. Byron asked Michelle what the problem was, and she explained that, you know, I'm new to breastfeeding. It takes me a while to get him situated.
Well, and plus, the baby's 3 days old. She's still working on this breastfeeding thing.
Yeah.
She probably doesn't even have much in the way of milk production yet.
So a few minutes passed, and Connor quieted down. After a few more minutes, Michelle noticed that Connor wasn't moving or breathing. Michelle looked at her son, and she couldn't feel or hear a heartbeat either. So they went into action. Marty began CPR, and it was 7:40 p.m. when Byron called 911. The 911 dispatcher sent help, of course, and offered to help with CPR instructions, but Marty had already taken a class, and he knew what to do.
So paramedics arrived at the McNerney home within 4 minutes of the 911 call. They took Connor from Marty's arms and began resuscitating him. Now, they attempted intubating him to help get air into his lungs and to continue the CPR, but they had a hard time intubating Connor. Finally, they were able to place it and give him oxygen by bag with the tube in place. So the endotracheal tube is a tube to assist in breathing. It's placed between the vocal cords and down into the area where the airway divides to go to each lung. So you want to be above that so you get air in both lungs. And with this case, at some point, the tube got displaced and was in one of Connor's lungs.
But they didn't know that at the time.
No, I know. You're supposed to, when you place the ET tube, bag the baby and breathe and listen on both sides, and you should hear air sounds on both sides to indicate that you're in the right place.
Yeah, and we don't know if they did do that or not.
We don't.
But this was an urgent situation, and they weren't used to intubating a three-day-old.
If you've never been in one of these things before, you have no comprehension what it's like.
No, it's really sheer panic, even if you know what you're doing.
It is. So one paramedic was bagging the infant, which means that they were breathing for him. Another was continuing chest compressions, and a third tried to put an IV in. So they tried to start an interosseous line. And that's where you just go into the leg bone below the knee and just try to get it into that, and the bone marrow will absorb the fluid. But this interosseous line didn't work. So then they tried to start a regular IV just in a peripheral vein, but they couldn't access the vein. And you and I know how tough that is.
Yes, it can be very tough.
In a newborn.
Sure.
And what they finally decided to do, since they didn't have a line in, was to give medication through the endotracheal tube, which you can do.
Yeah, you can. You just have to use a larger dose, and it's probably not as effective.
But it is a way of getting the adrenaline and other drugs into the baby.
So epinephrine was given in an attempt to start Connor's heart, but nothing was working. A paramedic contacted the hospital to let them know that they were on their way. Continuing CPR, the paramedics rushed Connor to the Olympic Memorial Hospital ER, and that was just over a mile away, but took a little longer than usual because of the storm, and Michelle was able to ride in the ambulance on the way to the hospital with her baby. So it was close to 8 p.m. when Connor was brought into the ER. Now, he'd been without a spontaneous heartbeat for over 20 minutes, probably 30. The ER staff was ready for them, though. They'd been notified they'd be on their way, and they had the crash cart with all the supplies and medications they needed ready to go.
Yeah, so, and they don't know really what the story is, right?
Not the full story, no.
So, we're taught, or we've always been looking at, well, If you don't have a heart rate for 20 minutes, that's sufficient to stop resuscitative efforts. So in this case, it's 20 to 30 minutes probably, but you don't know for sure. So you're going to put out the effort to try to resuscitate the baby.
Well, the paramedics arrived at, 7:44, something like that? And then they got to the hospital at 8, so they knew it had been a while. They knew it had been at least 15, to be generous.
Right.
Yes. But I think also it's a newborn baby, so nobody wants to give up, of course.
Oh, no.
You don't want to.
No. The only way possibly would be if the baby had been dead for hours and had rigor mortis setting, and then you might not attempt resuscitation.
But otherwise, you're going to give it a try.
You are.
Yeah. So in charge of the ER that night was Dr. Bruce Rowan, a specialist in emergency medicine. Dr. Rowan was 33 years old with a wife and a 3-year-old daughter. Most of the hospital staff saw him as a brilliant and very caring doctor. He seemed very down to earth, and they trusted him. He was originally from Iowa, so he had this folksiness about him, and he would tell patients to call him Dr. Bruce. But Dr. Rowan was not a hospital employee. He was an emergency room specialist working in a partnership with other doctors who had a contract with the hospital. Each of these doctors rotated 12-hour shifts, and most worked about 24 hours a week. The specialized ER work paid very well, though. So you're working about 24 hours a week. He was earning $185,000 a year, which I looked it up, and that's equal to about $330,000 in today's money. So a job that most of us would envy,
yeah.
At least pay-wise.
You work, so you 2 12-hour shifts.
Yeah, basically.
Basically. So you figure you've got 2 days of work and 5 days of off time.
Yeah, but I mean, to offset that, it's a high-pressure, stressful job, even in a smaller hospital.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that. It's very stressful.
Yes. So it's probably good that they didn't work more hours than that in that environment.
Well, they'd burn out quicker.
Yeah, it was a small hospital, so you were either really bored or you were, running around in a panic state.
Yep.
Pretty much not a lot of in-between.
So he was the emergency room physician on the night Connor McInerney was brought in. Bruce was already busy with several cases, so he called in one of his partners to help with a heart attack victim. And when Connor arrived, it was 8:05. His heart wasn't beating, and his only breathing was done by paramedics who were bagging him, pushing air down the tube and into his lungs. The hospital did not have a respirator for newborns, so they are obviously not going to take care of any critically ill infants or children.
Well, not for any extended amount of time.
Right.
But you can bag indefinitely.
You can.
Although it would be exhausting, but they have enough staff to do that.
Yep.
So the staff, of course, continued the CPR. With no heartbeat, his blood couldn't circulate, and Connor was suffering from brain damage from a lack of oxygen to his brain. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, his blood would circulate a little if they were doing chest compressions. So it's not that his blood didn't circulate at all. It's just maybe not effectively circulating. No, but it's a substitute. A poor one, but it will provide some help.
I just didn't want people to get the impression that it was just as good.
No.
Because it's obviously not.
It's not just as good. So if we've got a brain that's not getting oxygenated blood, it's going to build up carbon dioxide and some other metabolic waste, as we say, which leads to acidosis in the cells. And this kills the body's cells, including brain cells. But if you're not getting oxygenated blood, any organ in the body can be affected. So in the brain, the acidosis brain cell death begins with higher brain structures like the cerebral cortex, then quickly moves down to the structures that control breathing and heartbeat. And these are in the brain stem, which is at the base of the brain. So overall, these systems will begin to shut down after just 4 or 5 minutes with no breathing or circulation. And then brain damage and brain death can occur. It's an emergency, obviously. You have to try to get the airway and breathing and circulating of blood to help resuscitate the child. And you want to do this effectively so that there's little to no brain damage.
So when Dr. Rowan first saw Connor, he saw that the baby's arms and legs were cyanotic, meaning that they were blue from the lack of oxygen circulation in his blood. Rowan knew from Marty and Michelle and the paramedics that Connor hadn't had a heartbeat at this point for at least 25 minutes. There had not been oxygen circulating to his brain cells, or at least not adequately. So it was almost certain at this point that Connor had massive brain damage. But still, not everything is known about the development of an infant's brain in the first week of life, so it was remotely possible that a stabilized Connor might still develop some higher brain function if he could survive. Now, the only way to be sure would be to test for electrical brainwave patterns with an encephalograph. But Olympic Memorial Hospital didn't have one of those. So you were telling me something about whether or not an EEG encephalograph would actually be the only way to tell if the child was brain dead. So what other way is there to tell?
Well, you can do an arteriogram and look at blood flow in the brain. That's one way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a variety of medical tests that look at brain function, brain stem function, in terms of like withdrawal from a pinprick or pupils of the eyes being dilated and not movable, doll's eyes where you move the baby's head back and forth. And there's a variety of things that might not tell you definitively that there's brain death, but at least will get you in that ballpark.
Yeah, these are things that are going to let you know of the neurological status of the infant. So Dr. Rowan continued working to save Connor. An IV line was started in Connor's upper arm, and a chest X-ray was taken. Epinephrine and atropine, already administered by the paramedics earlier, were given again. Still no response. Dr. Rowan gave Connor more epinephrine, and when he ordered that bagging and compressions be stopped to check for a response, Connor was still without a pulse. So not breathing, no heartbeat.
For like half an hour.
Half an hour now. You know, on the conservative side, I'd say that. It could be longer.
Right. So Rowan gave Connor a dose of lidocaine, and this is a medication that treats rhythm disturbances in the heart. And I know you're going to say, but he didn't have a heartbeat. But he might have been in ventricular fibrillation or something where you can't register a heartbeat. So the lidocaine was just to see if that would produce any effect.
Well, at this point, we're pretty desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the heart monitor showed a disorganized heartbeat. It began at 100 beats a minute, but it was irregular. There were now 39 minutes since the call to 911. Now, bicarbonate was administered through the IV line. Now, the bicarbonate is for the acidosis that occurs when you have cell death because of lack of circulation of blood. We were always taught that you didn't administer bicarb without doing electrolytes blood tests because of the potential to cause problems with the bicarbonate. That's kind of a moot point at this stage of the resuscitation.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I think they're very desperate. They don't have time to do blood tests at this point. They couldn't even find a vein to put an IV in.
Well, they did have an IV finally.
But it took a while.
Yeah. So they did what I assume is a blood gas. Results showed that his blood carried a high level of oxygen, but also a dangerously high level of carbon dioxide. So Connor had excessive oxygen, and because the carbon dioxide wasn't being removed, he was getting more acidotic. So Dr. Rowan was bagging Connor with air while the baby's lungs were unable to exchange the gases. So we're in trouble. He got more bicarb to help decrease his accumulation of acids in his blood, and now his heart was beating. Admittedly, it was an irregular heartbeat, but it was working, so that's going to help. His blood is circulating, and he's going to get better oxygen-carbon dioxide exchange.
But he still wasn't breathing on his own.
Well, that's the whole other thing. I think he's been resuscitated, but there's nothing there. I think he's brain dead.
So, not going to hold you to it, but what would you do at this point in this situation? I'm sure you've been in similar situations to this.
Well, I am still at the point where I'm going to keep doing my resuscitative efforts. So in this situation, I would be happy that I was successful in getting a heart rate back. Even though the baby wasn't breathing, he was intubated and you could breathe for him. And he had a heart rate. Yes, it was after 30 or more minutes of resuscitative efforts. But I had something going. So I'm going to keep supporting that kid with oxygen and breathing and medications and so on and see if he'll stabilize. So I'm not going to stop resuscitation at this point. I probably would have stopped before then because I think they'd gone long enough without any signs of improvement. But once I got to a spot where I had a heart rate, then I'm going to keep going.
Well, you've kind of got yourself in the position where you have to at that point.
You're right.
Right. So they did do a chest X-ray, and that showed that the endotracheal tube wasn't properly positioned into Connor's throat. So only one of his lungs was getting oxygen. Like you said, it has to be above the two branches going to each lung, but it was actually just going down into one lung.
Yeah, it's really easy when you intubate. If you go too far, it'll slide right down the right-sided airway tube. So you're aerating the right lung and not the left. But all you got to do is pull it back a centimeter or so, and boom, got both lungs.
Yeah, and that's what Dr. Rowan did. So the follow-up x-ray showed that the tube was now where it should have been. Air was flowing into both of his lungs for the first time now in over 30 minutes. So Dr. Rowan tested Connor's blood oxygen level and found that it was in the 90s, and that's normal. Not in this situation, though. I'm surprised by it. But that came from the emergency crew manually forcing air into his lungs.
Yeah.
He wasn't maintaining that on his own.
Well, but I would say that the ER crew is doing okay because he had an oxygen saturation of 90s. In the 90s.
And I think they were pretty hopeful.
Yeah, I think from looking at this and seeing what's been going on, I'd be hoping that the child would continue doing well, and then we'd down the road evaluate for any brain damage. I'd be hopeful in that I got a heart rate, and it was being maintained, and I was breathing for him, so at least biochemically everything was looking better.
Olympic Memorial Hospital, like many small community hospitals, transferred their critical cases to a major medical center. And for children, this was Seattle Children's Hospital, which had the equipment and the expertise that the Olympic Hospital lacked. So early in the code, or the resuscitation, Bruce Rowan called Dr. Craig Jackson at Seattle Children's. Jackson was a neonatologist, which is an expert in treating newborns. Jackson gave Dr. Rowan advice on how to proceed with Connor, and Rowan asked that Jackson notify Airlift Northwest to be ready to fly Connor to the Children's Hospital. But at that point, the snowstorm was making a flight impossible. So after talking with Jackson, Rowan contacted Olympic Hospital's resident pediatrician, Dr. Catherine Sprenkel. Sprenkel then called the on-call pediatrician, who was Dr. Eugene Turner, to come in and take over for the care of Connor, because Dr. Rowan has other patients, and he's not a pediatrician.
But Dr. Sprenkel is, and she's the hospital resident. Maybe she just figured she'd call an attending physician in.
Yes. I think Dr. Turner was higher up. He was kind of the mentor.
Right.
Yes. So they're bringing in what they see as their best pediatrician, the best guy for this job.
So Dr. Turner got to the emergency room around 8:50 p.m., and this was more than an hour after Michelle had first noticed that Connor wasn't breathing. When he passed over Connor's care to his colleague, Dr. Rowan noted that Connor's heart rate was up to 150 to 160 beats per minute. At that point, I'd be pretty excited.
Well, that's a normal heart rate for his age.
Yeah, and this was a kid that had no heart rate for a long time. And, I mean, I guess my happiness would be tempered by the fact that he was not breathing at all on his own and still needed to be ventilated. But he had a good heart rate. That's great.
Dr. Turner had driven through the snowstorm from his house in the foothills, and by the time he got there, Dr. Rowan was really busy with more than one case, and that included an ectopic pregnancy with a fallopian tube rupture, which would require emergent surgery. So by this time, Michelle's obstetrician was in the emergency room with her, as were Marty and their friend Byron, Marty's mother Diane, and some other family members. And they waited outside of the treatment area as the hospital staff continued to work to save Connor. According to several witnesses, Eugene Turner seemed a bit off that night. As soon as he arrived at the baby's side, he was very clear on his opinion that there was no reason to continue resuscitation efforts. "This guy's had it," one of the nurses remembered him saying, right after he had taken over from Rowan. The chart showed that Connor hadn't had a heartbeat in at least 30 minutes. That meant that the infant was either severely brain damaged or even brain dead, in Dr. Turner's opinion. But Connor's medically restored heartbeat, as he called it, and the oxygen and carbon dioxide levels in his blood were continuing to improve. So a lot of the staff was seeing some hope in this. But according to them, Dr. Turner really was not hopeful.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be. I'd be encouraged by the fact that he finally did respond to resuscitative efforts, but knowing the history, my overall outlook would be pretty dismal for this baby in terms of his brain function.
Well, and that's where Dr. Turner was with it as well. Connor's pupils were dilated and fixed, and he was unresponsive to any stimuli. And later debate occurred over whether this was because Connor was brain damaged or if it could have been a result of the atropine, which does have the side effect of dilating pupils. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think if that was the only test that indicated brain death, that's not sufficient. And I wonder about the atropine. But in combination with all the other tests that they did, there's evidence that he is brain damaged.
Well, brain damaged, you can be brain damaged and still be pretty functional.
Well, so, I would think this baby's not going to be very functional.
Because they did poke him with the sharp instrument and got no response from that either. And Turner knew that he had gone without oxygen to his brain for probably quite a while. Who knows how long it took Michelle to notice he wasn't breathing.
Right.
And normally with a baby, if the heart has stopped, the breathing stopped a while back.
Yes, they follow along with each other. So, and they had company over to the house. They were playing a game, right?
Yeah, so she may have been distracted.
So maybe they weren't paying as much attention because the baby had just been nursed and was settled down to nap some more. So it might have been for some time.
But he's too young for SIDS, right?
I'd be not thinking of SIDS.
What would you be thinking of?
In a three-day-old?
Yeah.
Infection.
Okay.
That'd be my number one, probably. And maybe some congenital heart disease or something like that. But that three-day window, infection would be a big thing, particularly group B strep.
Yeah, I'd love to know if they tested for that.
Right.
98, they might not have. Small hospital in 1998?
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in Turner's medical opinion, Connor was so severely brain damaged that the chance of his survival was basically nil. Still, Turner and the rest of the emergency room staff continued resuscitation efforts. Now, some have speculated that Turner did this because he didn't want the others to think that he wasn't as dedicated as they were to save a life. And I could see if the rest of the staff is looking up and thinking things are looking better, it might be difficult to say, listen, this isn't a good sign necessarily, because everybody's hopeful. It's a baby.
Yes, it's a baby. So you're almost obligated to continue with your resuscitation because you got a response.
Yes, exactly. So after 9:30 that night, it was clear to Dr. Turner that further efforts to save Connor would fail. No matter what any of them did, Connor was not able to breathe on his own. Now, while his blood oxygen level was high at this point, and the carbon dioxide in his system was falling back to normal limits, Dr. Turner thought that he would die within minutes if resuscitation efforts were stopped. So he called the code, which means he stopped the resuscitation. Now Dr. Turner had to give this bad news to the parents, Marty and Michelle, which was heartbreaking. I mean, the parents are pretty much kids themselves. So he met with them in a private area of the emergency room, and he explained that Connor's situation could not have a positive outcome. He wasn't breathing, and although his heart continued beating at that point, it was certain that his time without oxygen had caused severe brain damage. So it was likely that if the bagging stopped, Connor would die. So Marty and Michelle agreed to have the hospital staff end the artificial respiration of Connor. The bagging stopped and the endotracheal tube was removed from his throat. Parents Marty and Michelle were brought into the room to see Connor, and a nurse wrapped him in a blanket. He was given to Marty to hold, and he was still in Marty's arms with his eyes closed. Michelle cried, begging him to breathe, rubbing his feet and trying to get a response. Then Marty handed Connor over to Michelle, and he began to cry. A nurse had to hold Marty to comfort him. The hospital chaplain was called in to baptize the baby, and Marty and Michelle were given some time alone with him. So at 9:54 p.m., Dr. Turner officially pronounced Connor dead. He told the supervising nurse to begin filling out a death certificate, and then he returned to the baby. He took Connor from Marty and Michelle and put the baby back in the baby warmer. Nurses escorted Connor's parents back to the emergency room front desk, and the emergency staff hugged Marty and Michelle and tried to comfort them. The McInerneys and their families left the hospital, and Connor was left alone in the baby warmer.
Then, a few minutes after 10 p.m., Dr. Rowan decided to check on Connor. He saw Dr. Turner at the emergency room desk, and Rowan asked what had happened with the baby. Turner told him that the baby had died. Now, Rowan would later say he was very surprised to hear that, adding that when he turned over the care of the baby to Dr. Turner, Connor appeared to be stabilizing. But, you know, this sounds like a little bit of an exaggeration from Dr. Rowan.
Yeah, I can't believe that Dr. Rowan was surprised.
No. You gotta remember, when he turned over the baby's care to Turner, Connor wasn't breathing on his own. Hadn't been. His heart was going somewhat. It was an irregular beat, but it was beating. And he had a fairly normal oxygen level. But Rowan had to know that it was really very likely that Connor had severe brain damage for all that time he went without oxygen.
And I think, you know, you have to think here, there were emotions involved. These are human beings.
Yes.
So a very emotional situation. Dr. Jackson, the neonatologist from Children's Hospital, then phoned to say that the helicopter from Seattle could now be flown. Earlier, the storm had prevented it, but he was told it was no longer needed because the baby had died. But that night in the ER was a strange one. The events after the McInerneys left the hospital would be pieced together through interviews of nurses and other staff working in the ER, but it's kind of incredible.
Yes, it is. So one of the participants in Connor's resuscitation was an ER nurse named Lori Boucher. She had worked most of that day and was scheduled to come back to work the next day. But with the snowstorm coming, she decided to sleep over at the hospital. So she had a beeper on her in case any of the night staff couldn't get to work and if she was needed to help out. So she had just gotten to bed around 7:30 when she was paged to come to the ER to help with the infant who was coming in that was in need of resuscitation. Lori got to the ER. She prepped the pediatric crash cart, prepared the medications that the baby might need, just got things set up. And along with Lori, the nurse supervisor, the usual night emergency nurse, Vicky, was there, and also a respiratory therapist named Dick Payne.
So remember, Connor had arrived at the hospital shortly after 8 p.m. Lori assisted Vicky in preparing and giving the IV drugs. She stood at the head of the baby warmer, so she really had a view of everyone during the code. After Connor's heart began to beat and his color returned, it looked to her like it was possible he may survive. Lori recalled later that Dr. Turner arrived and took over for Dr. Rowan. At one point, a suggestion was made that more bicarbonate should be given to the baby, but Turner said that they should wait. As it became clear to Dr. Turner that Connor was not going to recover, he told Marty and Michelle that Connor had no neurological response and he was likely brain dead. Turner told the emergency staff that once the oxygen was stopped, the baby would die. After Turner pronounced Connor dead and after the McInerneys had left the hospital, Lori returned to the room and began cleaning up. So she was planning to carry Connor's body down to the hospital morgue, but she had to get clearance before she could do that, so she was in and out of the room restocking the cart. Then about 10 minutes after 10, Lori said she heard a gasp coming from Connor, but then it wasn't just one gasp, which wouldn't be unusual. The baby was actually gasping 4 to 8 times per minute as she watched him. Lori touched his chest and she said she could feel his heart beating. At that point, the other nurse, Vicky, came into the room and Lori asked her to take a look. Vicky thought Connor was now breathing 10 times a minute, and she noticed that this respiratory rate was increasing as she watched the infant. So Lori had left the room to get Dr. Turner, who at that time was with Dr. Rowan. Lori told them about Connor and asked them to come with her to see for themselves. Back in the room, Turner picked up the baby and started to vigorously rub his back. Lori remembered him saying something about the possibility of miracles. She put the oximeter back on Connor's foot, and his oxygen level was 95% on the room air with no bagging. His color at this point was pink, but he was still neurologically unresponsive. So Turner checked the baby's eyes again, and according to Lori, Turner still believed that the baby was so severely brain damaged that he would soon die. Because there was nothing else to be done, he went back to his clinic across the street. Now, according to Lori, when she asked if he wanted to be notified when the baby died, Turner said no. So his behavior does seem a little off to me.
Does, doesn't it?
I think he's a realist, and I'm on board with that, but yeah, it's a little strange. Oh. I think he probably should have stayed with the baby until the baby was definitely deceased.
Yeah, hindsight's easy, right?
That's true.
We've got a kid a newborn who's been resuscitated, who's breathing spontaneously, whose heart rate is pretty good, whose oxygen saturation is excellent. So the thing at this time is to treat him, make sure he gets IV fluids, he'd probably start antibiotics, monitor his vital signs, that type of thing. And if it turns out that he never awakens or regains consciousness, then you think about doing electroencephalogram or other studies to determine brain death.
He'd have to be transported to Seattle Children's for that.
That's what I would have done.
Yes. But could you really call him stabilized for transport?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's not going to be too far of a trip anyway. But still, he has spontaneous pulse and spontaneous respirations.
Right.
That's pretty stable.
But the whole situation was unheard of. I mean, that's really weird, isn't it? It doesn't happen.
Well, it can, but the result's not going to be good.
Well, yeah, you can't just have your heart not beat for 10 or 20 minutes and then everything's fine because it starts beating again.
Exactly.
But I don't know if all the staff was really aware of that, but like you said, at this point, you have to deal with what's right in front of you.
Yes.
But none of the staff had ever experienced anything similar to this at all. So the options they saw were to preserve the baby's organs for donation, to start working to save his life again, to fly him to Seattle for advanced treatment, or to allow him to die with Marty and Michelle at his side. Now, what option would you have picked?
Well, we already talked about that.
Fly him to Seattle.
I'm flying him to the tertiary hospital so he can get specialty care.
But that didn't happen. But still, Connor seemed to be getting better. Oxygen saturation got up to 97%. Dr. Rowan asked the nurse supervisor to call Dr. Turner back to the hospital. And when he returned to the ER, then they discussed options. All of the options, of course, would require them to notify Marty and Michelle that their son Connor hadn't quite died after all.
That would be a tough conversation, wouldn't it?
Yes. The hospital would need their permission to continue any further medical care, but Dr. Turner didn't want the parents notified. And I think he genuinely did want to spare them from further grief and trauma.
Well, that's the whole story with this guy.
I think so.
What a caring, compassionate physician he is. So, yeah, I can see that.
Well, and he'd have no reason to not want to save the baby if it was possible.
Right.
So what Turner did is he suggested they just take things one step at a time. They continued to observe the baby, who did continue to pink up, but there was no change in his neurological status. Now, at one point, Lori checked the baby and noticed that he had something like a hand grasp with what looked like a clonus-type jerking of his arms when she let go of the grasp.
So it sounds like he's having a seizure.
Which means?
Well, you're going to see this in resuscitated infants and children, that even if they're fairly quickly resuscitated, there's a length of time that they've been without oxygen, and that leads to cell death, and that can lead to seizure activity.
So does that mean he's neurologically intact in order to do that?
No.
But I think that's what the nurse saw it as, a sign of, you know, he could do things. He was neurologically working,
well,
for lack of a better phrase.
But he wasn't doing things and he wasn't neurologically working. He was having a seizure, which is just a physiologic response to the difficulties that the baby'd had.
Sure. I just don't know if the staff there was seeing it that way. Remember, they don't always work on infants.
Yeah, well, that's up to Dr. Turner to explain things to them.
Yes. Well, Dr. Turner had some issues that night.
Apparently.
So Connor's lower extremities remained flaccid, but Lori saw his respiratory rate increase to 16 to 20 breaths a minute, even though she still described them as gasps.
Yeah, I don't know how I could describe them as gasps with his oxygen saturation being so good. And if he's got gasping respirations, that's not an effective way of breathing. And I wouldn't expect his O2 sats to be as good as they were.
Well, that's the thing about the story, is we're getting it from different people's perspectives.
Right.
We don't have all the facts. It's just not possible to have them because people were seeing things differently.
So they called Dr. Turner back to the ER, somewhat oddly, after deciding earlier that Connor should be allowed to stop breathing because he was brain dead. Dr. Turner now decided to reintubate the baby. So he tried several times, maybe as many as 15 times, without success. Dr. Rowan offered to do it, but Turner waved him off, saying, "I need the practice."
Yeah, this is where I'm really confused. I don't understand why he did this. I mean, I need the practice is a shocking statement, but why did he try to re-intubate?
I can't tell from the notes. You've got the baby breathing spontaneously, and his oxygenation is acceptable. So you don't need to intubate him.
If
they weren't effective, his O2 saturation would be falling precipitously.
Right, got it.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't understand this at all.
So Connor's throat became bloody and raw from all these attempts at intubation. So Dr. Turner and others from the scene later confessed to being confused about what he, Dr. Turner, wanted to do. Many people said that Dr. Turner seemed to be oddly detached that night. Normally a warm and involved person, he just seemed to have no enthusiasm for what he was doing. But he seemed compelled to go through the motions that everyone else expected of him. It seemed that Turner's logic was telling him that the baby would die, while his emotions and the expectations of others pressed him to try more medical interventions.
Yes, so in the next hour or so in the ER, Dr. Turner closed Connor's lips, pinching them with his fingers. When he did this, Connor's oxygen level decreased. But when he let go, the oxygen levels went back to normal. No one knew the extent of Connor's brain damage, though, because the Olympic Memorial didn't have the equipment to measure the brain function. But like you said, there are things you could do to get a good idea.
Yeah, and he's not looking good.
Now, the only way to measure Connor's brain viability was by looking at his fixed and dilated eyes and his lack of response to stimuli. And when these tests were performed, he continued to have no reaction. So it was possible that a severely brain-damaged Connor could go on for weeks or months, or they thought maybe even years, with no chance of regaining consciousness. And this would be a really traumatic outcome for his family. The young parents had already been through one of the most painful losses anyone can experience, and to call them back to the hospital then to tell them that Connor had not died but was not really alive either just seemed cruel. Dr. Turner refused to let anyone notify the parents. He continued to watch the baby breathe on his own. And at one point, he brought up a recent article he'd read in a medical journal that suggested that quickly cooling the body temperature was a method of jump-starting the body's nervous system. He called it a dive reflex.
Yeah, and now, 20-some years later, this is part of the therapy for newborns that have suffered brain injuries.
So it was a real thing, and it's actually an acceptable thing now.
It is. And a good percentage of kids that get resuscitated at an outside hospital and transported to, say, Maine Medical Center, when I worked up there, would end up on hypothermia cooling, and that preserves brain function, hopefully, and reduces the death of cells.
So it's a little late to be trying it, kind of. But also, the nurses weren't familiar with this. They took it as an order, though, and they prepared ice-cold towels and wrapped the baby in them. Nothing changed, though. Connor had no neurological response to this. Dr. Rowan now had some concerns about Turner's course of medical treatment, so he went to his office and called back Dr. Jackson in Seattle. And he said, "This is kind of a political call." He explained that while he wasn't an expert, the treatment with the cold towels seemed out of line to him. Now, Jackson wasn't familiar with the treatment at the time either. Rowan asked him if he'd be willing to talk to Dr. Turner, and Dr. Jackson said he would. So Rowan said he'd get Dr. Turner to come and give him a call back. But back in the baby's room, Dr. Turner asked the nurses if he could just stand alone with the baby for a few minutes. So all of the nurses left for a short time. Then just before midnight, Nurse Vicky returned to the room because she'd heard an alarm going off. The lights had been dimmed, but she could see the monitor and the oxygen saturation was down to 45%. As Vicky walked over to the monitor about 2 feet away from Dr. Turner, she saw that he was holding Connor in his arms. She saw the baby's face and Dr. Turner was pinching the baby's nose. So she didn't understand what he was doing. She turned off the alarm on the monitor and Dr. Turner said something to her like he couldn't stand to watch this go on much longer. But Vicky was very upset by what she saw, and she left to find her supervisor, Ann Duren. She told Duren about what she had seen, then Duren went into the room with Dr. Turner and the baby. Nurse Lori also returned to the room, but all she overheard Duren say to Turner was to ask him if he'd like some juice. Lori volunteered to go get his juice, and when she returned, Lori saw Ann Duren in the doorway of the baby's room, and she looked upset. Lori went in and saw Dr. Turner with his hand over the baby's mouth, pinching his nose. She was surprised, and she noticed that Connor was cyanotic, and his oxygen was low, and his heartbeat was 50. So according to Lori, Dr. Turner saw her, and he let go of the baby's mouth and nose. To Lori, it looked like Dr. Turner was suffocating Connor. Then he put his hand back over the baby's mouth and nose as Lori left the room crying. Almost immediately, Lori ran into Vicky, and Vicky could tell that she was very upset. So Vicky went back into the room herself. But Lori went to tell Dr. Rowan what Dr. Turner was doing. Rowan was just hanging up from his conversation with Dr. Jackson, and Lori told Rowan that he needed to go into Connor's room and see what was going on. She thought Rowan would know what to do. So Rowan went into the room just as Turner was leaving. Rowan told Turner that Jackson was waiting to speak with him over the phone, and Turner left the room. At that point, Rowan and Lori looked at the baby. Connor was blue and cold and obviously dead. It was clear to Dr. Rowan and Lori that Dr. Eugene Turner had smothered Connor to death.
So the circumstances of Connor's death were soon known to most people at the hospital. The nurses who had observed Dr. Turner's treatment of Connor were shocked and upset. Medical professionals who had been trained to save their patients were horrified by Turner's apparent mercy killing, which to them was immoral and illegal. Eventually, Lori took Connor's body to the morgue. She decided that she would report what had happened to the hospital's director of nursing services. That's Joyce Cardinal. As she was on her way to Cardinal's office, she saw Sue Grisiatis, and that's Ann Duren's relief as the night nursing supervisor. Sue told Lori that they needed to talk to Cardinal right away. Lori told Sue she was on her way to Cardinal's office. And in Cardinal's office, they were joined by two assistant administrators of the hospital. So we're rounding up the folks quickly. Must have caused quite a stir at the hospital.
I'm sure it did.
Lori told them what she had witnessed and that she was upset about Turner's actions. Someone needed to tell the McInerneys and the authorities, she said. Now, Cardinal assured Lori that steps were being made to notify the appropriate people. Nurse Vicky had gone home by then, but she too was feeling very emotional about Connor. And the emergency room manager called Vicky at home to ask her what had happened to Connor.
Yeah, so Vicky told the manager basically the same story that Lori had told the director of nursing. She said that while discussing treatment options, Turner had been adamant about not calling the McInerneys. Turner had said that it would be too upsetting for the young couple to be told that their baby was still alive, but with no chance at a real life. This complicated the group's decision-making because any further treatment would have required the parents' consent. But Turner had continued to insist that the baby would die if left on his own. So the nurses believed that Turner was just trying to hurry things along. After Turner had left the room and then returned later, he almost seemed to have changed his mind, though. This is when he decided to bag him. He got a bag and mask and then tried to reintubate. Now, he'd forgotten his glasses and said he couldn't see well, so he borrowed Lori's glasses and attempted the intubation. This was taking way too long, so Vicky asked Dr. Rowan to help. Dr. Rowan attempted, and they didn't succeed, but Connor did continue his gasps.
Now, Turner mentioned the study he had read, according to Vicky, about cooling the baby to jumpstart the nervous system. At that time, Dr. Turner had said, "I can't stand it. I can't have this go on anymore." So Vicky believed that he was feeling compassion for the baby, and he felt that death was inevitable. But then she saw him suffocating Connor when she went to shut off the alarm.
Which is very shocking, in any circumstance.
Yes.
So the director of nursing wanted to know about the chart, the hospital's official legal record of what had happened with Connor. And according to the official record, everything with Connor ended at 9:54 p.m. when Turner had pronounced him dead, just after his parents had held him. But it was clear from Vicky's story that a lot more happened after that, which never made it to the chart. Nurse Ann Duren had been taking notes in pencil, thinking if there was a good outcome, the notes would be later transferred to the chart in ink. But if there was not a good outcome, then the notes would not be entered into the chart at all, which doesn't seem cool either. Vicky felt really uncomfortable with this, and she was concerned about the use of the cold towels, too. So at some point, Vicky returned to the hospital and filled out an incident report. She also spoke with Dr. Sprenkle, the pediatric resident. Sprenkle said that she wished that she had been there for the code, but she couldn't speak to any other issues as she wasn't there. So she doesn't want to get involved, basically. It seemed to Vicky that Sprankle didn't want to be at odds with Turner because he was higher up. He was her superior at the hospital. So then Vicky went to Dr. Bruce Rowan, and he agreed with her. He said he was surprised that the resuscitation ended so early, especially with spontaneous breathing, a good pulse, and good oxygenation. He said that something was wrong, and he had called the doctor in Seattle. Now, the primary question was a legal one. According to the statutes in Washington State, any licensed medical professional who was aware of any form of child abuse was required to report it to the police, the district attorney, or responsible law enforcement authority within 48 hours, and failure to do that is a crime. So this meant that Turner, Rowan, the nurses, and anyone else who was aware of Turner's nose closing could be criminally liable for this failure to report. And if the hospital was in on this, it too could be held criminally liable. But this was complicated. If the baby was brain dead or severely brain damaged, could you really call it child abuse? Some people would see Dr. Turner's actions as merciful for the baby and the parents. It wasn't as if there was any evil intent. At this point, hospital attorneys didn't feel clear about the details. It was clear that the nurses, especially Lori and Vicky, were very upset. And if the story got out before anyone understood what was really going on, it could be devastating for the hospital. So without enough information, they decided the public might not understand. So hospital attorneys issued directives that information about the events leading to Connor's death be kept strictly within the institution. As part of this internal investigation, Dr. Bruce Rowan was also contacted.
Now, Dr. Rowan was known for his calm and friendly bedside manner. He had been working at the hospital for just over a year. He was a physician who worked on contract in his specialty, emergency medicine. But Rowan's first love in life was travel. He and his wife Debbie had agreed in the months before their marriage, 6 years earlier, that emergency medicine was the key to the life they wanted. He would work 6 months to 2 years, earning a high income in the U.S., and then he'd take off for 6 months or more as a doctor in third world countries in Africa, South America, or Asia. He thought this would give him the best of both worlds. And Bruce thought, at least early on in his marriage, that Debbie agreed with this plan. But now they had a 3-year-old daughter. Debbie seemed to be happy staying in Port Angeles.
Connor's manner of death had disturbed Bruce more than his co-workers realized. As a child, Rowan had seen the effects of brain damage. His older sister had been born with severe brain damage, and it had affected the lives of Bruce and his entire family for many years. Now, knowing that Dr. Turner had smothered a baby left him feeling very conflicted. On the one hand, he intellectually understood Turner's reasoning. The baby was almost certain to die at some point because of the severe brain damage. But emotionally, Rowan's hidden resentment toward members of his own profession was brought to the surface. Doctors like Eugene Turner were arrogant, in Bruce's opinion. Turner's choice to decide who would live and who would die upset and frightened him. To Bruce, this brought out his worst fear, that he himself lacked the inner strength to walk away from someone who was beyond saving. So either he doubted those who were his mentors, like Turner, or he doubted himself. He had always felt that becoming a doctor was demanding and that human emotions had to be set aside to do the job. Bruce Rowan had several emotional crises over the years, too, even being hospitalized and dropping out of med school for some time. He finally did go back, choosing emergency medicine, because he believed he wouldn't have time to get attached to his patients. So Eugene Turner did end up talking to Connor McInerney's parents. He told them what had actually happened after they had left the hospital. He explained that sometimes the body might go on living even after the brain had died, even though there was no hope of recovery. So this was why he had ended Connor's life. The McInerneys told Turner that they understood. The executive committee of the hospital decided to report the event to the medical commission rather than the police as soon as possible. Now, when considering whether Dr. Turner should be suspended, at least until issues were sorted out, the consensus was that the hospital did not want to appear like it was punishing Turner because that would be seen as an acknowledgement by the hospital that he had done something wrong.
And they're just trying to cover themselves legally, basically.
That's exactly it.
Now, over the next several days, Rowan and nurses Vicky and Lori exchanged phone calls, and they tried to reassure each other that they'd done the right thing in reporting Turner. But, you know, they began to feel as if they were the bad guys of the hospital community, even though it had been Turner who had smothered the baby. Now, as it turned out, just about anyone who knew of the smothering was at legal risk, so the hospital hired attorneys for all of the staff involved. The hospital's efforts to protect Dr. Turner and themselves and hold off telling the police succeeded for only 8 days. On January 20th, a hospital orderly came home from his shift after he had heard all of the stories at the hospital. And he called up his neighbor, who was a sheriff's deputy, and then the deputy called the Port Angeles police.
Yeah, I don't know whose idea that was to try to keep it private. It's never going to work.
Yeah, well, that's kind of how they do things, though. Yeah, many cases we could talk about doctors being protected by the hospital.
Oh, yes.
So a few days after that, Detective Sergeant Terry Gallagher, after filing an affidavit saying there is probable cause to believe the crime of murder has been committed, had a search warrant for the hospital. Normally protected hospital information, from the ER nurse's statements to the executive board's minutes, had to be handed over to the authorities. Then on February 1st, a police press conference announced an investigation into the death of an infant. No names were mentioned, but the next morning, the local Peninsula Daily News ran its first story about it. Now, it didn't have many details, but the article did identify the doctor as Eugene Turner, and many Port Angeles citizens were really angry at the newspaper. How could the Daily News tarnish such a man with no solid evidence? Like I said, Dr. Turner was very loved in Port Angeles. He had a lot of supporters.
He certainly did. Well, and again, he'd been there for 30-some years, right?
Yes.
So a lot of people knew him. A lot of people had been taken care of by him.
They trusted him.
They did. So while the investigation into Connor's death continued, and the district attorney was considering charging Dr. Turner with second-degree murder, Debbie Rowan, who's Bruce Rowan's wife, tore her Achilles tendon. So Bruce took her to an orthopedics doctor, and surgery on Debbie's Achilles was planned for Monday, February 23rd. Now, fortunately, Bruce was off that week, and this would allow him to take care of Debbie while she recovered. Bruce took Debbie to the hospital on February 23rd, and waited at the hospital while she was in surgery. When she was still coming out of the anesthetic, he left the hospital and went home. And later on, Bruce called extended family members to let them know that Debbie was all right. Later, he brought their 3-year-old daughter to the hospital to visit Debbie. Now, Debbie wasn't going to be able to walk for a long time. Now, she's going to be non-weight-bearing for some time. And then even with weight-bearing, she'd still be on crutches. On the way home from the hospital the next day, Bruce stopped at a medical supply store and bought a pair of crutches for Debbie. Now, her convalescence put pressure on Bruce. Instead of Debbie doing the shopping, the cooking, and the cleaning, it would all be up to him. Aw.
Well, he wasn't used to it.
Instead of Debbie taking care of Bruce, which was their normal way, Bruce was going to have to take care of Debbie. And I'll say, aw, one more time.
You can say aw all you want, but Bruce Rowan was a fragile guy who relied on his wife to take care of him. And taking care of the kid and the house and her, that was kind of overwhelming for him.
Apparently.
So on Sunday, March 1st, 1998, Debbie was still recovering from her surgery while Bruce took their daughter shopping. They bought plastic garbage bags, a miniature wooden baseball bat, an outdoor vacuum cleaner, and some snacks. That evening, he and Debbie planned to see the movie Titanic at the mall. Bruce arranged for a babysitter to stay with their daughter, and around 4:30 p.m., he drove Debbie, with her crutches, to the theater, which was just 10 minutes away. Bruce hated the movie Titanic, but one scene where a deck officer shoots and kills himself really stuck with him. It kept playing over and over in his mind. In fact, he'd say he just couldn't stop thinking about it. Now, Debbie, on the other hand, loved it. She loved the romantic parts. She thought it was a great movie. After the movie, Bruce and Debbie came home and chatted with the babysitter for a bit, and neither of them could get to sleep right away, maybe because of all the junk food both of them had eaten at the movie theater. But also their daughter was up, and at some point she was in Bruce and Debbie's bed. At another point, their daughter was in her crib and Debbie was dozing in the bed. Or maybe Debbie had decided to go to the store. Bruce really couldn't be clear on the sequence of events that night. In fact, he'd never explain exactly what happened that night, but he would, however, admit that what happened to Debbie was gruesome and tragic. So I'd like to take a moment here to tell our listeners about True Crime Brewery Premium. If you would like to support our show and get episodes ad-free, subscribing to TCB for ad-free and premium episodes might be just the thing for you. Once you subscribe, you get our regular episodes ad-free, plus a special members-only episode each month, and a gift that I'll send to you. You get to choose a set of coasters, a bottle opener, or the classic TCB snifter. Just go to tiegrabber.com and look at our subscribing options. Also, there are over 150 shows in this members-only show for you to listen to and binge. You also have the option of subscribing through Patreon, and you can do that by going to patreon.com/tiegrabber. Either way, you'll get your own personal subscription link that you can paste into your podcast app so you can listen there as well as on our website without any commercials or promotions like this one. So I think it's worth it. Now, one more thing, if you have comments, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation to share with us, I'd like you to send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or better yet, you can leave us a voicemail. I have a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail for a future show.
And for the months of May and June,
anyone who gets their voicemail played on the show will be sent a free TCB steel wallet-sized bottle opener. So we'd really love to hear from you. Let's get back to our story.
So late on the night of Monday, March 2nd, a man named Jefferson Davis, who happened to be the son of a deputy sheriff, was driving south on the Mount Pleasant Road. About 15 minutes into his trip, Davis saw a late-model Subaru Legacy wagon lying sideways across the drainage ditch with its lights on and its engine running. So it looked to Davis like the car had run off the road and crashed. Davis stopped his car to see what was going on. Inside, he saw a woman lying across the front seat. In the back seat, he saw a child's car seat that had been flipped over. So he's naturally worried that a baby might still be in that seat. So he opened the back door and took out the car seat, was very relieved to see it was empty. He looked back at the woman in the front and saw two deep gashes in her forehead. Blood was visible on the driver's headrest, so it appeared to Davis that the woman was dead. He got back into his car and called in the apparently fatal accident. McClallum County deputy took his call, drove to the scene. The Subaru was sideways in the drainage ditch. It looked like it had possibly run into a large fence post and run off the road. When the deputy looked in the car, she saw the dead body of a young woman lying sprawled across both seats. The car's airbag had been activated, and the dead woman had a cast on one of her legs.
So the police called in the traffic investigator, but they already knew that what they were looking at was not a traffic accident. The windshield of the car was intact, but there were two huge cuts on the forehead of the dead woman. On the floor of the car, there was a wallet with the ID of Dr. Bruce Rowan. The two gaping cuts in the victim's forehead were two open flaps of skin in slight arcs in two different places, and some of her teeth looked broken as well. On closer inspection, they saw that blood was actually everywhere. The wounds didn't look like they had come from any accident that the investigators had ever seen before. In fact, they looked like they'd been intentionally inflicted by someone. There was blood inside the car's door jamb, too, which meant that the woman had been injured before the car went off the road. So, it looked like a homicide. The car's license plate was run through the state's vehicle licensing computer, and it came up as being registered to Bruce Rowan at 241 Yellow Rock Lane, a house less than 200 yards away from the crash scene. So two deputies drove to the house, and as they pulled up, they saw something in the driveway in front of the garage, a pair of crutches. So the two deputies knocked on the front door, and Dr. Rowan answered, and he seemed to be waiting for them. So this was an odd situation, to say the least. They had a woman dead from severe head injuries less than 200 yards from her home in a car that had no broken glass. And her husband seemed unusually calm with no concerns for where his wife was at 2 a.m. When asked about her whereabouts, Bruce said he just wasn't sure. He said that she'd left to go to the supermarket around midnight. A deputy told him that there'd been a car crash and that Debbie was dead, and Bruce fell to his knees, and the deputy led him to sit in a chair. But then Bruce seemed instantly composed. He explained that since her Achilles operation in late February, Debbie had not been able to drive. But, he said, Debbie decided to try and do it for the first time that night because they were low on food and other household items. Bruce also suggested that the cast may have interfered with Debbie's driving. So this just doesn't sound legitimate.
Well, it doesn't, does it? She's not driven at all since surgery. Somehow she decides at midnight that she needs something at the store and she's going to drive.
Right.
That just boggles me.
Well, he did seem to be cooperating, but his story made no sense. Even if Debbie had decided to drive to the store at midnight, which, yes, it's very unlikely, why would she leave her crutches in the driveway? I mean, she was non-weight-bearing, so she'd need them to get anywhere. Investigators put together a more likely story than Rowan's grocery store story. They thought that Bruce had killed his wife, then put her dying or dead body into the car. Then Bruce started the car, backed out of the driveway, and drove down Yellow Rock Lane to Mount Pleasant Road, where he arranged Debbie's body in the driver's seat, put a heavy trailer hitch over the gas pedal, wedged a plastic water pail into the steering wheel to hold it straight, put the car in gear, and let it roll down the hill. The traffic investigator had estimated that the car had been going 40 or 45 miles per hour when the front right side wheel turned into the drainage ditch. The right wheel had hit a metal culvert, which caused the car to move to the right, sending it into a fence post, setting off the airbag and throwing Debbie across the front seats. So if this is what happened, there would have to be evidence of the murder somewhere on the Rowan property. Bruce consented to a search, but a warrant was requested from a judge just to cover all bases. Investigators got the warrant and started searching that same night.
So blood was found on the crutches. On the gravel driveway, they saw two drag marks. And on one side of the driveway, there was some coagulated blood. As the search continued, Bruce went to the bathroom and attempted suicide. He stabbed his neck several times and plunged a large knife into his chest repeatedly. He told the detective that he had been aiming for his aorta, and Bruce said voices told him to do that. An ambulance was dispatched to the house, and Bruce described his condition as if he was his own patient. He knew that he was being taken to the hospital, and he began making plans for the care of his daughter, who was awake at this point. He was read his Miranda rights, and he explained to his daughter that someone would take care of her. Bruce was rushed to the emergency room at Olympic Memorial Hospital, where people who knew him as a brilliant and calm doctor tried to stabilize him. A small complication, potentially serious, he had nicked the left ventricle of his heart when he was stabbing himself. And he had some internal bleeding. Not only that, but because of the bleeding, his blood pressure was falling, and he was becoming less conscious from loss of blood.
Yeah, he was actually unconscious for a couple of days, and of course had to have surgery.
Yeah.
So I only say that to let you know that it was probably a genuine attempt on his own life, I believe. I don't think he was playing around.
Oh, no. If you got a large knife and you're stabbing yourself in the chest and you're saying, I'm trying to get my aorta.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's serious.
Yeah, I can't imagine being able to do that. Now, in the search of the house, a blood spatter pattern was identified on the carpet, the walls, and the ceiling of the bedroom. There was a large amount of blood soaked into the underside of the mattress. So Bruce had removed the bedding, tried to mop up the blood with paper towels, and then flipped the mattress over before taking fresh sheets and blankets from a guest bedroom to make up the bed. Besides Bruce and Debbie's bedroom, more blood was found in their daughter's room, in the bathroom, and on paper towels that had plugged up a downstairs toilet. Outside of the house, deputies found a small lawn cart with blood on it. A still-running hose was lying in some wet cat litter with shoe prints on the driveway, and the litter made a messy path to a shed in the backyard. In the shed, deputies found several plastic garbage bags that were full of bloody clothing, paper towels, and bedding. There was also one bag that was just full of blood. Investigators thought that this bag may have been put over Debbie's bleeding head to keep the blood from her head wounds off of the floor. Now, blood was also found in three sinks, both bathrooms and the kitchen. Debbie was not wearing a bra, and they found a blood-stained bra in the washing machine. In the shed, deputies found a large single-bladed axe, which was clean. There was also a small wooden baseball bat in there. Since these were found together, police considered the axe and the bat to be likely murder weapons. On the pathologist's first look at Debbie's body, he'd noted that both cuts on her forehead had flaps of skin that he could peel back to show massive cuts into her brain tissue. The cuts matched the wound patterns expected from an axe. So Debbie had been struck 3 or 4 times with the axe blade. Then Debbie's jaw and teeth had been broken, likely from 1 or more blows with that baseball bat. The lower jaw blows could not have been fatal, which indicated that the axe had probably been used first. The baseball bat blows may have happened afterwards in an effort for Bruce to make it look more like an accident.
Based on Bruce's account of the night and what the police looked at, like telephone records, it was around midnight as Debbie lay in bed when Bruce left the house. He walked to the woodpile on the side of the house, picked up the axe. Going back in, he hit Debbie's forehead with its blade at least twice. Then he got the small baseball bat and used it to crush her jaw and lower face. Horrible amount of injuries.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A tooth and pieces of teeth were in the bedroom, along with the blood spatters. And after killing Debbie, Bruce had gone outside for the lawn cart and rolled it across the deck to the bedroom's deck door. Bruce had then loaded his dead or dying wife into the lawn cart, took it around the deck to the driveway. He put Debbie's body on the ground. Then he dragged her into the car. And at the purported crash site, he arranged her body upright in the driver's seat and sent the car off. He returned to his house and did some more cleanup after that.
But it was really difficult to think what Bruce Rowan's motive could have been. When they looked into the couple further, they found out that Bruce had taken out a $500,000 life insurance policy on Debbie, and the policy went into effect on March 1, 1998, the same day that she was killed. The Olympic Memorial Hospital administrator told members of the media that it was not likely that the death of Connor McInerney had anything to do with the murder of Debbie Rowan. But this was challenged by Bruce Rowan's attorneys. They would say that the murder of Debbie had been triggered by the actions of Eugene Turner in the emergency room of Olympic Memorial Hospital back on January 12, 1998.
Now, after being in the hospital for his self-inflicted injuries, Bruce Rowan was charged with first-degree murder. In jail, he was held in a padded room on suicide watch. He was put on 3 different antidepressants and evaluated psychologically. According to his attorney, not a day went by with Rowan not thinking about what put him in that cell. He was described as very sorry and very sad.
Bruce Rowan pled not guilty by reason of insanity. This would work in his favor at trial because the prosecution had to prove he was guilty of murder beyond a reasonable doubt. But all the defense had to do in this case is show that Bruce was insane by a preponderance of the evidence, so just over 50%. But we all know that insanity defenses are some of the most difficult to prove in criminal law. Mental health experts rarely agree about insanity, especially in difficult cases like Bruce, because he was so high functioning. As a result, when insanity or diminished capacity is contested in court, juries almost always find the defendant sane. There actually had not been a successful jury acquittal on an insanity defense in almost 25 years in the state of Washington. So it was kind of a long shot.
Certainly was.
The defense told the story of Bruce Rowan's mental health history and his feelings after the Connor McInerney death. Ever since the night of Connor's death, Rowan was experiencing some really distressing emotions. It was more than the death of the baby. He felt conflicted about what had happened, and he began to feel estranged from his colleagues. In his mind, people were blaming him for Turner getting into trouble. And this was a familiar cycle of thoughts for Rowan. All of his life, he'd been tormented by self-doubt and perfectionism. His fear of failure drove him to worry and to push himself to succeed in everything. Also for Rowan, his wife Debbie was his strength and his sole supporter. But by late February of 1998, even Debbie had become a cause of stress for Bruce. She wasn't taking care of him anymore. She was relying on him. So he believed that killing her would save her from the pain she would feel when he eventually committed suicide. Now, at the end of his trial, the jury deliberated for almost 24 hours over 3 days, and when they returned with a verdict, it was not guilty because of insanity. So the judge asked them, did the defendant kill Deborah Rowan? And the jury foreman said yes. Do you find the defendant not guilty because of insanity existing at the time of the act charged? Yes. Is the defendant a substantial danger to other persons unless kept under further control by the court or other persons or institutions? Yes. Does the defendant present a substantial likelihood of committing felonious acts, jeopardizing public safety or security, unless kept under further control by the court or other persons or institutions? Yes. Is it in the best interest of the defendant and others that the defendant be placed in treatment that is less restrictive than detention in a state mental hospital? And the jury foreman said no. So Bruce was insane, a danger to himself and others, and he should be locked up in a restrictive hospital setting indefinitely.
In December, Dr. Turner pleaded not guilty to second-degree murder in the death of 3-day-old Connor McInerney at Olympic Memorial Hospital. Turner said that the baby was brain dead when he put his hand over its nose and mouth to stop reflexive or agonal breathing. In fact, Turner said that he believed Connor was dead even before he left the house. But some hospital personnel said that Connor was gasping for air and had turned a healthy pink after Turner gave up his resuscitation efforts. Dr. Turner continued to treat patients in his private practice after the baby's death. Now, even though he surrendered his privileges at Olympic Memorial Hospital after the baby's death, more than 350 people signed a petition asking the hospital board to ask him to return. The hospital was cleared of any wrongdoing in this case.
In early February of 1999, prosecutors dropped that second-degree murder charge against Dr. Turner. He was cited by the Medical Quality Assurance Commission, and he was banned from making decisions on when to end patient resuscitation. It was determined that he showed a gross lack of judgment in the care of the infant. Dr. Bruce Rowan has not been reinstated as a physician, and his and Debbie's daughter was raised by Debbie's sister in Colorado. The daughter was given the life insurance payout of $500,000. Then, in 2005, Bruce Rowan was released into the community, and no further murders by him have been reported, so that's good. Eugene Turner is now 86 years old and retired. So this is a very strange situation for me to be in, because I think I agree with both outcomes.
Yeah, well, that's not strange.
No?
No.
Well, I definitely think that Bruce Rowan was insane. But with the pediatrician, Dr. Turner, I think he meant well, but what he did was not the right thing to do.
Not to be too trite about it, but as a physician you take an oath, the Hippocratic Oath, that begins first, do no harm.
But I guess the question is, was he really doing harm if the baby was already brain dead? Maybe he wasn't doing harm, maybe he was helping.
Well, he might have thought he was doing the right thing, but he directly caused the baby's death.
I think he may have accelerated the death of the baby. Well, I wouldn't say he caused a healthy baby to die.
I'm going to be arguing two different things. The baby was not dead.
So it really wasn't appropriate for him to make that decision.
No, it was not.
So really interesting story. Glad I found it, especially for us to discuss. I really thought it was great.
That's amazing, the proximity of these two cases to each other.
Oh, I definitely believe that it was related. I think that Bruce Rowan was really affected by it. He was mentally ill and not affected by it in a normal or reasonable way. But I do think he was affected by it. Doesn't mean he wouldn't have killed his wife or done something like that another time over something else, though. He was definitely mentally ill and struggling.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, TCB's music was produced by Mike McClellan. And you can find out more about his work by going to his website, podcastps.com.
It's time for listener feedback.
Okay, Dickie, what have we got for feedback?
I got a bunch for you today. So let's do some voicemail first. First one up is Katushka, and she has two cases for us.
Hi, you guys. I am a huge fan of the podcast and have been for years. And yeah, just absolutely love listening to y'all's breakdown. And I have two case suggestions for y'all. The first one is the death of Eve Carson. I believe in 2005, she was the student body president at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Her death was so tragic and random. It is a solved murder case, and just a really fascinating, the story is more the life that she lived. She's just such a remarkable human being and the impact that her death had. The other story is lesser known. It's a woman named Jessica Edens in South Carolina. She killed her two children and her ex-husband's girlfriend in kind of just this rage as a way to get back at her husband. They were either in the process of getting divorced or had recently been divorced. It's a really devastating case, and I haven't seen very much media coverage about it. So first case, Eve Carson in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The second case, Jessica Edens murdering her children and her ex-husband's girlfriend. So we'd love to hear y'all cover both of those cases. Thank you so much. Y'all are seriously couple goals. And yeah, can't wait to keep listening along. All right, bye.
Thank you, Katushka. Appreciate it very much. Any comments on those cases, Dickie?
Yeah, the Jessica Edens, after she killed her kids and killed the woman she thought her husband was having an affair with, then she killed herself.
Yeah, that's tragic, but I never understand when people try and get back at someone by using their own children. And of course, in this extreme case, by killing their own children.
I know.
Obviously, she was mentally ill, but definitely a tragedy. And she left him alive?
Yes, husband didn't get killed.
So that's how she punished him, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, those are both cases I will definitely look into. They both sound like they have some potential.
I think they do. And this next one is one we've talked about doing an episode on, and we've just seen a documentary about this case to remind everybody. So this is from Emily.
Good morning, Dick and Jill. My name is Emily, calling from Tampa, Florida. You guys are by far my favorite podcasters in the whole podcasting realm. So don't ever stop or I'll be heartbroken forever. But on to what really is important, a case suggestion. I do have one that I've always wanted to hear from you guys. It's Peter Madsen and Kim Wall, who is a Swedish reporter. She went to go interview Peter Madsen in his mini submarine. They both went down, and only Peter Madsen came up. I just think it would be so exciting and would love to hear the detail that you guys go into. And I know that you guys would just pull it off really well. As far as beer suggestions, I know you guys frequent Tampa pretty often. And I'll be quite honest with you, I've been casually drinking Michelob Ultra, so I don't think that's something that you guys are interested in. But if I come up with something, I'll leave another voicemail. But other than that, you have a fantastic day, and I can't wait to hear if you guys do this case. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Emily. Now, this is actually a case we're pretty familiar with. We did watch a documentary about it, read a book about it, and I think there's a second documentary that I was thinking of watching. This is really the case of a man who was really kind of a devil in disguise, and it's fascinating. One of the documentaries, I believe, doesn't even use his name, which I really like the idea of not using the perpetrator's name and really focusing on Kim, who was a wonderful young woman.
Yeah, the whole story. Obviously, this inventor guy is insane.
Well, warped at least, yeah.
Okay. But it's a very interesting story. We've talked about doing it. Now you've given us the impetus to go ahead and do it.
I think we will, yes, absolutely. Also, I don't know about the Michelob Ultra because Tampa has a lot of great beers, but I would never judge anyone's tastes. It's fine.
Yeah, I was leaving that one alone.
Yeah, but you know, I enjoy a hard seltzer here and there, and if Dick gives me a dirty look, I just ignore it.
Yeah. Okay, how about another voicemail? This is from Shelley with a case that she wants to do.
Hi, Dick and Jill. This is Shelley from Central Illinois. This is my fourth attempt at recording this, so if I really mess up, you'll have to forgive me. I don't want to have to try again. I'm a new listener on YouTube, and I really appreciate you taking the time to research and do these shows. I have a case suggestion for you. It's the 2008 murder of 32-year-old Stephen Watkins. Stephen Watkins was a single father of a little girl that he was raising on his own. He met and married a woman named Jennifer, and then they had a child, a little girl named Sydney. Shortly thereafter, I believe their marriage fell apart. Jennifer's family was very religious and, from what I understand, a little bit controlling of their child, Sydney. After a while, there got to be a custody dispute, and Jennifer and her family alleged that Stephen Watkins was abusing their daughter, Sydney. Those abuse allegations were unfounded, according to the Department of Child and Family Services here in Illinois. So he was continued to have visitation, but the visitation and custody battle was ongoing when he went to go pick up his daughter for a visitation at his former wife's grandparents' home. And at the time he went to go pick up his 17-month-old daughter for visitation, he was shot in the back of the head. Jennifer's family said it was in self-defense and the grandmother shot him in self-defense, but that does not appear to be the case. There was also a little bit of a cover-up because many people, including some in the Skinner family, have alleged that the grandmother, Shirley Skinner, did not kill Stephen Watkins. It actually was his estranged wife, Jennifer Watkins, but she took the fall for it so that Jennifer wouldn't have to go to prison. So anyway, Shirley Skinner was convicted. She's now 87 years old and she's in Logan Correctional Facility. But the saga continued for quite a few years because the grandparents on Stephen Watkins' side sued for grandparent visitation rights to Sydney. That set off another battle with the visitation rights. And when they were to get some visitation rights, because their son was now deceased, and they wanted their other grandchild by Stephen to have a relationship with Sydney. Sorry, this is long. Jennifer fled with Sydney, the child, to Florida. This is part two of my case suggestion because I talked too long. I apologize. The mother took off with Sydney to Florida. She was there for several years, I believe, trying to evade the visitation. There was no allegations or abuse or anything. I'm not sure why she didn't want the grandparents to have visitation. Jennifer was even jailed for 5 months one time in Florida for refusing to give up the location of Sydney. She had hid her or placed her with some other family member so that she wouldn't have to do the visitation. She was eventually found and brought back to Illinois for interfering with visitation. So she was jailed for a while. There was custody dispute for quite a few years. In 2018, it was finally settled. And Stephen Watkins' sister is now the primary physical custodian of Sydney. And the mother only has supervised visitation. What started out as a dispute between husband and wife, former husband and wife, over visitation and custody became a 10-year protracted battle with many court visits and a lot of allegations back and forth. But this case has several things that may be interesting to you. It has some religious stuff, some abuse allegations, a dispute whether it was murder or self-defense, a cover-up with some alleging the grandmother did it, some alleging that the daughter or the granddaughter, the former wife of Stephen, did it, the grandparent visitation, the flight out of state. There was a Dateline episode on that called The Mystery on Horseshoe Drive, Season 19, Episode 5. And I do think this would be an interesting case and has a lot of aspects. Thank you.
Thank you, Shelley. So very thorough. I did edit it down a little bit because it was very lengthy, but there's really nothing to add. She gave us even the episode number of the Dateline episode.
She's done all the work for you.
She's done all the work. We can just throw together an episode this evening, I think.
Doesn't work that way.
No, but thank you, Shelley.
And we have one more voicemail. This is from Kat.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Kat. I'm from outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. I found you guys during quarantine and have been blocked everything the past couple years. I get super excited every time you guys put a video out. I have a case for you, the Stephen Stainer case. There was a Lifetime movie about this called I Know My Name is Stephen. And recently, you can't remember if it's Netflix or Hulu, has a documentary out where they re-interviewed everyone and also interviewed the actors that were in that made-for-TV movie. It's super fascinating to me. It's a tragic story. He was kidnapped and then found, which was amazing. And I would love to hear what you guys think about Kate. Also, for a beer recommendation, we have Victory Brewing, not far from where I am. And they also have sour beers, which I absolutely love. And Jill, I know that you do too. So I would love if you guys tasted those and let us know what you think about it. I hope you guys are doing well. I love you and have a good night.
Thank you, Kat. Really good taste in beer. The sours are wonderful. And Steven Stainer is a great idea. I would really love to cover that. We actually did watch the new docuseries. I believe it was on Hulu. And I remember watching the made-for-TV movie years ago and just being fascinated with it. So that is an excellent case that we will definitely cover. Thank you for that recommendation. So we have a couple of emails.
We have one from Bex and one from Nate, two of our good friends.
Yes. So Bex writes, I'm out so I can't call, but I heard about a fascinating case. Martin Tankleff was arrested on his first day of his senior year of high school for the murder of his parents. But all is not what it seems. It's a fascinating case. It involves money, unpaid debts, possibly iffy police tactics, and redemption. Arrested in 1988, served 17 years, then released on appeal, and is now an attorney.
So he was arrested in 1988 and served 17 years and then got released on appeal. But he went on to college and law school after his release from prison, and he is now an attorney.
Excellent. Thanks, Bex. That's a great recommendation as well. And then we have one from Nate. And Nate writes, a crime and murder spree that began in Idaho and ended in Arizona. Three murders in Idaho, a young boy now missing for more than a decade, and a murder-suicide in Arizona the day after the case was featured on America's Most Wanted.
So Nate sent a bunch of sources, which will help us quite a bit.
Pages and pages of links. Thank you, Nate.
So the Idaho murders were solved 10 years after the fact, and the murder-suicide occurred after the suspects were seen on America's Most Wanted.
Well, this is very interesting, so let's not go into more details. Let's save it, because I think I'd like to do an episode on that one as well.
Yeah, I kept it short.
No spoilers.
Nope, no spoilers there.
Well, I am such a happy woman to get all those voicemails. And if I have to bribe people by sending a gift to record voicemails, I'm okay with that. So please keep them coming. So if your voicemail is played on our show in May or June, I will send you a gift. Just send me your address if you'd like to get the gift. You can send that to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com or jill@tygrabber.com, and we'll get that right out to you. We really appreciate all of your feedback, emails, and voicemails, and we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
Come on down, share a beer with us.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.